Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secure retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in. Because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast. I'm the Big Mike.
Mike Zlatnik, and today it is my pleasure and a privilege to welcome Neil Bauer. Hi, Neil.
Thanks for having me on the podcast, Mike.
Thank you kindly for coming on a podcast. Neil is known as the mad scientist of multifamily. He is a technologist who is universally known in the real estate circles. He manages over $1 billion AUM and he's a data guru. So once again, welcome. And tell us a little bit about Neil first. Where you live, family, a couple of words on that topic, and then we'll dive into what's happening on a data front of multifamily.
Of course. So I'm a technologist, data science background, computer science degree, had a successful tech career. During that tech career for 14 years, I was running a company, grew it from 10 to 400 employees. I live in Texifornia, so I had the big fat tech salary and I was paying 50% of my salary in taxes. And so really got into real estate for tax reasons, for tax depreciation benefits. So from 2003 to 2013, built campuses for my company and also bought lots and lots and lots of single family homes when, you know, other people were nervous about them in 2008 onwards. And from 2013 onwards, they have been working with investors. So about 1,000 investors, we've taken about $300 billion of their money to buy and build about $1 billion worth of assets, which now I think are probably worth only $700 million because there's been a decline in value.
Yeah, I appreciate that point. That's an early point that you bring. So you're seeing 30% correction, if I understood that correctly.
Not quite. We've sold off a bunch of assets. So I think the correction that we are seeing in our assets is probably closer to 20%, but I expect that number to go up. I expect that the final number, the final correction from peak will probably be 25% or 30%. We'll see. We'll see how long it takes for the Fed to get the rates down. Because every month that the Fed waits, the value of multifamily continues to fall. Which is a great opportunity, by the way.
Well, it's a great opportunity, I guess, to buy fresh, right? But it's more painful for the existing investors in these projects.
Extremely painful. And I think that if you call yourself an investor, not a speculator, you have to understand that what has happened in the past is not representative of the future. Just like the future was never representative of the past either. So while you sort of absorb that pain, understand that the people that are buying today are getting an incredible deal.
Yeah, great minds think alike. It's kind of funny. I had a similar career as you in technology and a lot of similarities and gravitate real estate for many similar reasons. And now that's exactly the key point. Past performance are not indicative of future results. In the last couple of years, performance has been bad, very difficult for equity, and the future outlook is drastically different on a forward deployment of capital, on the new money, if you can get deals deep enough. Are you seeing these deals yet? So the market is, say, corrected 20% in your view, but it may correct 25-30%. What would be the driver for you to take action at this point?
We've already started taking action because one of the fundamental things, you know, as a data scientist, somebody who uses numbers and remembers thousands of different numbers in their head, one number that I remember is my track record in predicting bottoms and tops is a flat 0%. So I've been wrong 100% of the time when predicting the bottom and 100% of the time when predicting the top. So I use the Warren Buffett model. Warren Buffett doesn't wait to predict a top and a bottom. And he often says it in his Berkshire Hathaway presentation that he hasn't managed to figure out where the top and the bottom is either. He buys when it's cheap. So anytime you start getting 20% off on an asset without its net operating income having decreased, well, that asset is cheap. And so I've already started purchasing. I bought a $30 million asset, which was appraised at $36 million just 6 months ago, 7 months ago. And those kinds of assets are, at this point, unquestionably inexpensive, especially if you can get loan assumptions. So this particular asset, we assumed a loan. It was 79% LTV. It was about a little over 5% fixed rate for 5 years. Interest, IO. I mean, that's wonderful because you're getting a 20 to 25% discount off of market value. And why are you getting that discount? Because you have to pay high interest rates. Well, if you go out and assume a loan, then you don't have to, deal with that, right? So when you're doing using an assumption, you're getting the good part of the deal, but not the bad part of the deal.
I concur with that point of view, and the difficulty is to get both the discount and the assumable mortgage. I've seen if you get a deal with assumable loan, you don't get as much of a discount versus a deal that you have to bring your own cash at a much higher cost of money, but you get a bigger discount. Are you seeing sponsors taking big haircuts, or was it a transaction where the sponsor was just trying to get the principal back? I'm just curious, under what
This isn't a
circumstances you're able
sponsor, it's a
just to
family that has its own money, and they have 30 plus assets, and some of their assets need to be refinanced, so they have to sell some of their good assets to come up with cash to get their other assets refinanced. So there's a lot of reasons why people sell good assets that are highly occupied in every market, including this market. People get divorced, people have kids, people need to raise money for health reasons. So there's plenty of assets in the marketplace. As you said, the assets that are marked down the most are the ones without the assumable loans. The assets that have the assumable loans are still discounted, but not discounted as much as they should be.
Yeah, I got you, but it's still a great opportunity if you can get that fixed rate debt. At least you have that security or safety for the duration of a loan. And what's your, and it's a crystal ball question, but this is a fundamental assumption that and many of us have to make in underwriting multifamily, any commercial deals. Are the interest rates going to come down, or they're going to stay at this elevated level for a long, long time? Because basically, depending on the point of view, some people are saying with the government printing press accelerating, they're just difficult to see how the interest rates will come down unless things really get broken in the system.
I don't know why people say that. I think that a fundamental understanding of economics is necessary, and very few people in real estate have a good understanding of economics. They don't spend enough time looking at this. So let me say this, and it's what I'm going to say is a little technical, right? The federal funds rate, the Fed doesn't actually change interest rates. They change an internal interbank lending rate called the Fed funds rate. And the Fed funds rate is currently between 5.25 and 5.5. And it's been there for the last 7 months. And inflation is currently somewhere around 3.25, right? And Fed wants it at 2% or as close to 2% as they can get. It's at 3.25. Please understand that internal Fed documents reveal that you don't need a Fed funds rate at 5.5 when you have inflation at 3.25. It's too high. It's much too high. They're just keeping it there for a certain amount of time so that they can be very, very sure that inflation is coming down. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that the US economy is weakening. We only produced 175,000 jobs last month, where we produced 300,000 jobs earlier in this year. I see manufacturing shrinking. I see the price of shipping containers from China to the US reducing. So the economy is in a good place, but there is zero doubt in my mind that current interest rates or the current Fed funds rate is artificially high. Why? Because the Fed wants to make sure that it doesn't have a double, sort of increase problem where they drop interest rates, then inflation goes up, then they have to raise rates again. They don't like that at all. So they're being careful. And the Fed doesn't mind putting the US economy into a recession. It's not something they want to do. So in my mind, this concept of, well, all the recession risks have gone away. No, there's a possibility, a significant possibility of a soft landing. But I still think that the way this mostly works is that the Fed ends up putting you into a recession. So this thought process that today's Fed funds rate somehow is the long-term Fed funds rate has no bearing in reality. It is only real on YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram. From an economics perspective, there is absolutely no necessity for the Fed to keep the rate this high. And if they continue to keep the rate this high, The only possible scenario is that the US economy goes into a recession. And when it does, they'll cut rates. So this feeling that, oh, we might keep the Fed funds rate at 5.25 to 5.5 for the next 2 years is truly, truly absurd. You keep in mind that we kept it at 5.5% over the last 12 months. Inflation's gone from 6 to 3. Now, it's been sticky for the last 4 months, but that is the nature of inflation. It doesn't come down smoothly, right? It's going to come down and then be sticky and then come down and then be sticky. That is how it works. And if you look at the last 60 years, the Fed's raised rates 14 times, 9 times we've gone into a recession. And almost every time, the downward curve of inflation has not been smooth. So it goes down, then sometimes even goes back up a little bit and then goes back down. That's normal. That's how it's happened every single time. So we are currently putting a tremendous amount of pressure on the economy. In fact, there was a Fed meeting day before yesterday. Oh, sorry, 3 days ago. I think it was on Wednesday. And in that meeting, the Fed didn't change rates. They didn't raise them. They didn't drop them. But you know, they made an announcement that should really make everyone think about this absurd idea that interest rates will stay this high. Fed does two things to slow the economy down and to reduce inflation. One is interest rates. The second one is called quantitative tightening or QT, where the Fed basically buys less bonds from the market. So as the bonds renew, the Fed doesn't buy them again, which reduces liquidity. And they've been reducing liquidity by $70 to $90 billion every month for the last year, every single month. And now they're slowing that because they're feeling the pressure on the economy. The Fed tries to look 6 to 9 months into the future when making their decisions. They're not looking at today's economy because there's no point in looking at the economy. Rates have to be predictive in nature. 6 to 9 months down the line, they're seeing weakness. And that's why the Fed said on Wednesday, we're going to reduce quantitative tightening. So the Fed isn't thinking about raising interest rates more. The Fed isn't thinking that we might stay where we are. The Fed simply knows it's a bumpy path.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's a lot of great nuggets in that and that wisdom. I happen to believe into a similar long-term point of view that the interest rates have to come down, that the Fed funds rate should be floating somewhere on a long-term basis around where the inflation is. So we are very restrictive right now. But let's talk about long-term rates, because most of the mortgages are tied to the long-term rates. And the 10-year Treasury has been, it has moved up quite a bit. And it's back to about 4.5% range at the time of re recording. And it's pretty high. Most of the real estate investors hope and pray, which is not really a strategy, but they certainly express the view that where it needs to be in the 3.5% range. We need to have a normalized yield curve where the Fed funds rate is lower than the long-term bond rate. So what do you think on a long-term basis, where the interest rates on a 10-year treasury, which will drive where the mortgage rates will be, will normalize when we get out of this cycle? And in the underwriting of many deals, the only thing you can really rely on is the assumption where the 10-year treasury is gonna be. And that'll drive the cap rates, it'll drive a lot of assumptions. So I'm just curious. Your point of view, you certainly expressed your view that the Fed funds rates has to drop sooner or later. What about long-term rates?
I don't think it drops back to where it was before COVID. So it doesn't drop back to 2018, 19, or 17, simply because we have to finance a significant amount of, debt. And so I think it's 5.5 right now. I think it probably drops to 3.5, then drops to 3.25, and then it sort of is dependent upon where the economy is. So we get a significant drop from here, but it doesn't go back to where we were on a pre-COVID level. Now, keep in mind, there are two simultaneous things that are going off that are pulling in different directions. And I don't know, I don't think anybody knows which of those two tugging in the tug of war is going to be more successful. On the one side, the world economy is slowing. Now, inflation tends to drop when the world economy slows because inflation is an indicator of demand. When demand slows, right, inflation slows. So, if we didn't have all this debt and the world didn't have all this debt, there is no doubt in my mind that long-term treasury rates would be going in the downward direction. Please note that they have been declining for decades, right? They've been going downwards for decades for lots and lots of different reasons. And throughout that time, we were printing money. Just so you know, all of that time, 70s, 80s, 90s, when these long-term rates were declining, we were printing, 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 and printing. So nothing's really changed, except we're printing more than we used to. Bottom line is this. Because world population growth is tanking, right? Places like South Korea are only at 0.6% baby, where 2.1 is the replacement rate. So you got to have 2.1 babies to replace, you know, it's just your population stays the same. They're at 0.6, 0.7. Japan's at under one. So with the exception of India, which is also slowing radically, but still reasonable, China is in a horrible place. So with world demographics slowing so drastically and the number of kids slowing so drastically, inflation should be going downward. So that's pulling in a downward direction. But debt tends to pull us in an upward direction, except what we've seen unusually in the last few decades, is that when you have more debt, your growth slows because of the debt. Why? Because you can't make productive investments into your economy. You can't build infrastructure. You can't do research, R&D. All of that goes away because you're just paying interest. Well, when you do that, the economy slows. Well, when the economy slows, demand slows. When demand slows, inflation actually drops. So Japan's a perfect example. They are at 270% of debt. We're at 135, roughly, right? 135, 140. They're double our level of debt. Japan is a shrinking economy because they have a shrinking population. It's been shrinking now for decades. You would think that interest rates would be extremely high in Japan because they are 270% of GDP. They're clearly not a growth economy, and they keep borrowing more and more money. But do you know that their interest rates are usually much lower than ours? So there's two things pushing down on interest rates, the slowing of the world economy and the fact that debt itself tends to slow an economy. And then the third thing is, well, we got to finance this debt, so we have to make it attractive for other people. I don't know which of those three forces are going to win. But so far, what we've seen is the downward force is winning, with the exception of the last 18 months, which I have absolutely no doubt in my mind was driven by COVID and Ukraine. So those were, you know, what we've seen in the last 18 months was absolutely driven by, you know, first by COVID, then by Ukraine. So I think we cannot use the last 2 years as a benchmark of what is happening to inflation. There's still a lot of downward pressure.
Well, that's a lot of data in very, very short summary. So you did believe that the interest rates have to come down as overall global inflation is going to come down. That's the conclusion of the long story, right?
Yes, I just don't know how much, right? So will it come down? Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind that the current rates will put us into a severe recession sooner or later, right? So the Fed is basically simply saying we'll keep them where they are until we think that inflation's, you know, on its way down towards 2%, and then we'll drop them. So it is not a question of whether rates will drop or not. It is a question of when. And the Fed says, as long as the economy is strong, there's no pressure on us. We'll be flexible. We'll wait.
Yeah, that's a great point. I too happen to believe they're going to break consumer, because consumer is tapping in the credit cards more and more, and they're tapping into retirement savings. So sooner or later, the consumer is going to break. And when it happens, it's going to be
very likely. Spending.
Yeah. So I
keep in mind sometimes that doesn't lead to a recession.
The consumer breaks. Right?
So what happens in, you know, whenever the Fed raises interest rates, basically this cycle happens, interest rates go up, you know, people have more credit card debt. So this isn't anything new. We've done it 14 times before. This is the 14th time. So this usually ends with a recession, or it ends with recession-like conditions. So the other five times when the Fed didn't put the economy into a recession, we had recession-like conditions. It didn't quite get all the way down, but growth tanked. And when it tanked, obviously demand tanked. And when demand tanks, usually inflation comes down. Sometimes you get stagflation, but it's rare.
So with all these assumptions, what are you doing on the fresh capital deployment? That's the big, big next question. You're raising new funds. You're mm-hmm. deploying capital on new deals. Obviously, you mentioned the deal that you did discover at a assumable debt. What else are you doing? I'm just curious, what are you seeing? Where are you seeing the opportunity? Where are you deploying cash? On a new capital raise basis,
I am doing what is known as land squatting. One of my favorite strategies right now is land squatting. Land squatting is not the same as land banking. With land banking, you buy cheap land, you sit on it for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years until it, you know, goes up in value, and then you sell it. That's land banking. Land squatting is a very unique strategy. It only works when interest rates are extremely high. So it works for a short window and then just falls apart. in a land squatting strategy, when interest rates are at 4 to 5%, in this case, 5.5% is the Fed funds rate, developers stop building. When developers stop building, you get land buyers, basically their product, which is land, becomes illiquid. So right now, I am making hundreds of offers on high quality pieces of land all over the United States. At about 30% off of listed price value. And my biggest catch is I have 21 months to close. This is called land squatting because I'm not actually purchasing the land. I'm paying a small 2% deposit, which goes ha hard after 6 months. And then after that, I have another, beyond that point, I have another 15 months to close after the first 6 months. So I have 21 months to get through entitlements, get the land, zoned and permitted and do all of those kinds of things, and then decide whether I want to build something a year and a half from now or a year from now, or simply sell that as entitled land a year from now. Both, there definitely would be a higher price for entitled land in 12 to 18 months because rates will come down to a more reasonable level. And so I can just sell it as entitled land. And if I don't, I will then go ahead and build, and I'll have an advantage because I would have paid very little for that land. So land is cheap. Land squatting is a fantastic strategy right now.
You're buying an option on the land, effectively. Option and control, I
Yes,
guess,
a
over the property.
21-month option.
Yeah, that's a pretty powerful idea, and that strategy has been used by some of the big builders too. They don't want to own land, they want to own an option. So that's a pretty clever strategy that certainly works. It certainly is very powerful. Okay, that's a wonderful strategy. What else? You doing anything else? So let's squatting is makes a lot of sense in this environment. By the way, is it residential development land or is it some kind of
So
multifamily?
yes and no. So I'm no longer doing multifamily development with this land squatting strategy. I'm doing townhomes because I believe that we are getting to the point where middle class, not lower class, but middle class economic class Americans are now getting not able to afford a home after COVID. Remember, when COVID hit, 45% of all the homes in the market were affordable for a median home income on the day that COVID hit. Today, that number is 16. Right? So only 16% of Americans can afford the listing that is in the market right now. Only 16, one out of six, one out of seven, which means that a lot of people want to live in homes, but they won't be able to buy them. If they won't be able to buy them, what's the next best thing? Townhomes. So my strategy is to build townhomes, not apartments. I'm sure you can build apartments as well. There's nothing wrong with that strategy.
But when you say townhomes, do you typically mean single family townhome, or you're talking about possibly the possibility of building a duplex, triplex, quad, something up to four
Those
doors?
are not townhomes. A townhome basically is, it looks like, imagine a single family home, but now stick them together. And
So
most
I live in New York
townhomes,
City, so townhomes are everywhere.
So basically take a single family, start a single family home, 1300 square feet, and then just join the walls together and make sure that there's only one car garage instead of two and make the backyard smaller and you've got a townhome.
Okay, that's pretty powerful. I do believe that there is a substantial undersupply of residential units. That's been a well-known fact. And a townhome is fits in that. But I guess you're utilizing land very efficiently when you're building a townhome because it's a much better use of land, at least per buildable foot. You're using a lot less land. What else? We still have 5 minutes left. I just want to make sure we get a chance to share any great ideas, and then how would folks reach out to you at the Grow Capitals?
Sure. Well, first, I want to talk with people about mindset. Okay. In 2008, I was buying a single family home every month, and I was desperate. I wanted to buy as many as I could. I was going around begging and borrowing and getting cash from everybody buying them because my data science was showing it was the best time to buy real estate in 100 years. But almost everybody around me thought that I was a complete idiot. They thought that, I couldn't possibly be more wrong. Today, on the multifamily side, you have an opportunity to be buying multifamily at 20 plus percent off. Okay. By the time you go out and buy a property now, it's going to be 4 or 5 months down the line. So it'll definitely be more than 20%. I think this is the equivalent of that 2008 opportunity for multifamily. And I think that you have to find out how to convince your investors of that. That's the bottom line, right? It may not be as great as 2008 because that was a crash, but bottom line, there was a crash. There was a huge recession. There were millions of homes in the market. The risk was much higher. Today, there's no crash. Multifamily is not in any level of distress. There's a lot of people that think multifamily is distressed. This is a absolutely atrocious and stupid idea. Current delinquency rates, both 30-day and 60 days for multifamily, are 1/6 of those for single-family homes and 1/12 of those for credit cards. That is not a definition of distress. You know what's distress? 2,500 multifamily properties that, when they sell, will lose all of their investors' money. That is not a definition of distress for a market that's $4 trillion in size. So 2,500 properties will have investors that will lose some or all of their money. How can that be considered distress when there's a the total number of apartment units in the United States is 20 million, right? That's over 100,000 properties of 200 units each. And there's 2,500 properties that will be sold, losing money for people. That is not a definition of distress by any financial means. And so people keep thinking about these 2,500 properties, and they think that this is going to lead to some kind of run or some kind of distress in the marketplace. It's a truly absurd idea, but it's also extremely popular on Instagram or TikTok, therefore it must be right.
I appreciate that change in the mindset. I happen to agree that now is the time to be greedy when I was a fearful and be fearful when I was a greedy. So if you're looking for great opportunities, back to the Warren Buffett. Now maybe the opportunity to pick up some great real estate at a discounted prices, even though the discount is not large and widespread, but for the deals where there is a distressed owner with a capital stack that can't sustain the property, that's where the opportunities are. So what are you doing today, and how would folks get a hold of you just to
I think the best thing today is to really stay connected with the data, right? And that's how you can use the data. You can use it with your own limited partners. These are the two companies that I run, Mission 10K, which is building 10,000 rental townhomes, and Grow Capitus, which basically buys multifamily properties, right? So those are the two companies. But I think the one that you're interested in is neither one of these two. It's multifamilyu.com. So we have a website called multifamilyu.com, and we do about 12 very fun and interesting webinars. On the Multifamily U platform, about 25,000 people attend those. Go there, check those out. Like the data that I was mentioning today about the 16% of the homes being affordable for Americans, all of that data is on that website. We do not have a subscription. We do not have an upsell. We don't have an educational program. It's just a Wikipedia of real estate data. That's the best way to interact with us. So go to multifamilyu.com and connect with us. Of those 25,000 people, 1,000 are investors with us. The remaining, they're just there for the data. They're just there to take it and use it. Be one of those people.
Multifamilyu.com.
That's right.
Thank you, Neil, for sharing. Thank you for coming on a podcast. Appreciate your wisdom and your time.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.